The Madison Symphony Orchestra will be performing three concerts this weekend. They'll include Britain's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, Debussy's vast orchestral canvas La Mer, and equally vast, the second piano concerto of Johannes Brahms. And the pianist for that occasion will be Philippe Bianconi, who is here with me, Norman Gilliland, at the piano. And welcome back.
Thank you.
You performed for us once before. How long has that been? A couple of years now?
It was about a year and a half ago. I was here in Madison in the spring of 2012. I was here to play the Beethoven Fourth Concerto with the Madison Symphony, and you invited me in on that occasion.
You like those big concertos, don't you? Beethoven Fourth, Brahms Second.
Yeah, although Brahms Second is certainly a much bigger concerto than Beethoven Fourth, I think Beethoven Fourth is probably the most intimate of all of Beethoven concertos. The Fifth, the Emperor, is on a much grander scale.
Yes.
And the Brahms, especially Brahms Second, of course, is a much longer piece. It's almost 50 minutes. And it's a really big concerto.
What's the appeal for you in particular about that concerto?
It's been one of my very favorite pieces ever since I was growing up. And I think probably if I had to choose one concerto to go on a desert island, it would probably be Brahms Second. I would be very sad to have to leave behind a number of other wonderful concertos. But if I had to choose one, it would be this one. One of the reasons is that it is so symphonic. The orchestral part is so important. And actually, I have always felt that this concerto was more a symphony with principal piano than actually a concerto. It is very symphonic. The scope and the, as I said, the orchestra is so important, and the piano part, which is huge. It's one of the biggest and most difficult and most virtuosic piano parts. But at the same time, it's completely integrated in the symphonic texture and structure. And when I play this piece, I have the feeling I'm playing in a Brahms symphony, which is great because I love the Brahms symphonies. And I love that feeling of being immersed in that orchestral, you know, the colors.
The texture.
And the texture and the majesty. It's a very majestic piece.
It's interesting how concertos vary, that piano concertos in particular vary that way. Some of them written by composers who were known as pianists tend to have just an orchestral accompaniment. I mean, even Chopin has been faulted, I guess, for that a little bit.
Oh, definitely.
Whereas Brahms, it's the other extreme. The piano is, as you say, almost just another orchestral instrument.
Actually, with the Chopin concerto, definitely we have pianists' concertos because the piano part is so wonderful and the orchestra is reduced to, you know, very, very minimal accompaniment. With Brahms, it's interesting because Brahms was a pianist and a wonderful pianist, and it shows in the piano part. But at the same time, he became an orchestral composer. He waited for many years before he dared write his first symphony because the shadow of Beethoven and
yes,
the Beethoven symphonies was just too much for him, and he felt like he was not ready to do it. But when he started writing big symphonic works, then, you know, he wrote absolute masterpieces. The four symphonies, the big concertos like the violin concerto, the double concerto, and the the second piano concerto. The first one belongs to his earlier days and is a little bit different. But he developed this orchestral writing, which is so rich, it's so dense, it's so intense. And with the big piano part, because he was such a wonderful pianist, it in this particular concerto, it creates such a big... I have difficulties finding the right words, but it is absolutely, as I said, it's grand, it's majestic, and when you play it, it's on such a huge scale, you know, from the very, very softest moments to huge explosions of sounds, and this gorgeous, gorgeous balance between the piano and the full orchestra and the various components of the orchestra is just overwhelming.
Do you know, did Brahms ever play this concerto himself? His career as a pianist seems to have taken kind of an interesting trajectory early on. He apparently was, as you say, quite the pianist, but then it's more as if later in life that Clara Schumann played a lot of his works
That's right. He had a career, what we would call a career as a pianist when he was young, and then, you know, he was just not interested. I mean, what he wanted to be was a composer. But he kept... you know, playing the piano and I suppose practicing, because he was close to 50 or 50 when he wrote this concerto, and he played it.
Oh, did he?
He performed it, absolutely. And I have no doubt that he performed it beautifully, which means that, you know, he had to practice a lot in order to be able to play this very difficult part.
Is this one of those concertos where the piano comes in fairly early? That for a long time, the tradition was, of course, you had a big orchestral buildup, and then by the time we get to Beethoven, sometimes the piano is right there at the beginning.
Yes. Actually, in the first concerto of Brahms, the piano has to wait at least 4 minutes before starting. In this one, the piano starts right away, and actually the beginning is one of the most poetic beginnings that you could ever imagine. It starts with a solo horn that introduces the main theme of the first movement.
Brahms loved his horns, didn't he?
Yes, he certainly did, and it gives a lot of his music such a specific color. And in the at the beginning of the second concerto, you have this theme played by the horn, and the piano answers with a beautiful arpeggio. I'm just going to demonstrate. So this is the horn. So this is the main theme of the first movement. And this is how it goes, with the horn introducing the theme. And by the way, I think it's probably one of the most nerve-wracking things to do for a horn player, you know, to have to start just by himself or herself, you know, just the beginning of the piece. It's so naked, you know, but it's so beautiful. So here it goes with the horn and the piano answering with the arpeggios. Horn again. It's very quiet. It's so beautiful. You know, you can imagine yourself walking in the forest, and it is so, so romantic. And when you hear this, it's hard to imagine what's going to happen. Because, you know, this theme is going to go through a lot of transformations, and there are some really powerful, almost cataclysmic moments in the first movement, which you don't foresee when you hear this beginning.
Well, that kind of sylvan beginning is again, that's something that we tend to associate, though not exclusively, but we tend to associate with German music of the 19th century. Beethoven, of course, is famous for his walks in the fields and forests that inspired him so much.
Absolutely, absolutely. This, I don't think this music could be anything but German or Germanic. You know, Brahms was German, but when he wrote this piece, he had been living in Vienna for many years, as was Beethoven many years before. You know, they'd been living in Vienna, but it's so Germanic in character, in mood. It couldn't be anything else than, you know, music written by those composers.
So is that theme, that opening theme you just played, is it really that short and simple, and it drives this whole vast concerto?
Yes, definitely. Actually, you have, this is the very beginning. Then you have a second theme played by the orchestra, by the woodwinds, and then the strings that goes like this. And then the piano comes in a big cadenza, introducing, it's not really a theme, but it's more like a cell, very rhythmic, that will give the entire movement its rhythmic vitality. And it goes like this, and it's in complete contrast. Etc. It's not very long, but it's a pretty big cadenza, and it ends fortissimo, and it finally introduces the first big tutti of the orchestra, which, as you said, in earlier concertos would have been at the beginning. But here you have this long introduction, and then suddenly the orchestra comes in forte and plays the first theme that was played by the horn in full power. Etc. So within, you know, 2 minutes, you have so many different moods, and you went from this very quiet, beautiful, intimate presentation of the theme into this big explosion and this very different presentation of this theme.
It kind of intrigues me because, again, back in Beethoven's time, and I don't know when this practice fell out of use, but the custom was during the performance of a concerto or a symphony, which would typically have four movements, there would be something else entirely played between the first and the second movements of that work. I mean, and it could even be some kind of a novelty act. Mm-hmm. And then you'd get to the second movement, which in a way makes sense, because if you have a big dramatic movement like this, the audience has to respond somehow, rather than sheer silence going into the next movement.
Yes. I mean,
how do you feel about that whole sort of the drama of it and the theatrical quality?
Well, there is definitely in a lot of concertos this theatrical dimension, you know, and the contrast between the movements. In this particular concerto, it's very interesting. In general, Brahms uses classical form, you know, but what's really interesting, he did write four movements in this concerto, which is rather unusual and which makes it closer to a symphony. Most concertos have three movements. Symphonies have four movements. And this concerto has four movements. And it's very interesting because The first movement is the longest one. It's very majestic. It has a big, such grandeur and drama. And then normally you would expect a slow movement. Well, you have to wait another almost 10 minutes. After this movement, Brahms wrote a scherzo. And it's very different because it's much darker. It's very passionate. It's like a dark, really dark passion. But it's very powerful. So you have two very powerful movements back to back, which is very, very unusual.
Is that hard on the pianist?
Yes, it's not easy. It's not easy because, you know, normally after a big first movement, you can rest.
Yes, in the, slow down a little.
Rest, physically, at least, you can rest in the second movement. And here you can't. So it's interesting because there's a big contrast in character, in mood. The first movement is in B flat major, and it is, except for some darker moments, but it is in full light. The second movement is so dark and intense and passionate, but they're both very virtuosic and strong movements. And then you have the third movement, which finally gives you some peace and rest. It's one of the most beautiful slow movements ever in the whole literature, I think. And it's just wonderful. And then the fourth movement, some people have criticized Brahms for not writing a huge grand finale. Instead, Brahms wrote something which is more like a divertimento, and I've always thought of Haydn, actually. You know, I think Brahms goes back more to the Haydn tradition.
Well, we know he wrote those orchestral variations on
absolutely,
a theme of Haydn.
Absolutely, and he admired Haydn greatly. And this finale is in such contrast with everything else in the concerto. It is light, it is spirited, it's full of humor. It even has a gypsy theme.
He used those occasionally, didn't he?
He loved those gypsy songs and themes. And this also relates to Haydn, because we know, yes, Haydn used some gypsy
and one of the piano trios and dances.
Absolutely. And so the contrasts and the construction and the drama in this concerto is very, very interesting. You know, you go from a big, majestic first movement to this dark, smoldering scherzo, and then you have this gorgeous slow movement, and then you finish with a light, spirited finale. So it's really interesting, and it's very different from most piano concertos of the repertoire.
So it's not an anticlimax, this light finale?
I don't think so. Some people do think it's an anticlimax, but frankly, with a big first movement, a big second movement, I think a big finale would have been too much. And I think the balance is much greater. And to me, it's not an anticlimax, but I know some people who like to have a huge, big, you know, finale. And personally, I think it would have been too much, really.
Do you ever have the experience playing this that, and I've seen this happen once before when you played a concerto. Have you ever had the experience at the end of a big first movement like that, that the audience applauds?
Oh, yeah, that happens a lot. I don't know if it will happen here, but it does happen. Like, I played here quite a number of years ago. I played Prokofiev's third piano concerto. And the ending of the first movement is rousing. And there are very few audiences that can resist, you know, applauding because it's so exciting. And it's okay, you know, when it happens. It doesn't, you know, some people say, oh, my goodness, this audience is so uneducated.
That's right.
Don't they know there are two more movements to come? It doesn't bother me. I mean, you know, when there's excitement, why shouldn't we let the audience express, you know, their...
It happens in opera. Why
absolutely.
Not? Why not in a piece that in some ways is operatic?
Absolutely. Definitely. Definitely. So maybe if you allow me, I would just like to present the main themes of the other movements. So I told you about this really dark... passionate scherzo, and this is the main theme. This is how it starts, presented by the piano. And then there is this interplay between the piano and the orchestra with a lot of power and a lot of intensity. And then, very abruptly, Brahms introduces a second theme played very softly by the strings. And then the piano takes over. And it's in big contrast with the main theme. It is very dark, but it's much more intimate. Piano comes in. Then there is an interesting middle section, since this is a scherzo. You know, a scherzo is typically written in first section, middle section, which can be called a trio, and then back to the first section. And it introduces a theme that sounds very 18th century, you know, almost like some, it could almost belong to some of the royal music of Handel, you know, something like that.
Fascinating. Yeah, well, of course, Brahms also wrote variations on theme of Handel.
Handel, absolutely. And it's in very big contrast with the rest of it. And then, of course, Brahms starts variating this theme and brings it into very different moods. The first variation is played by the piano, and it's based on this theme, but it sounds completely different. So this is the theme played by the orchestra. And then the piano goes.
We're back in the 19th century.
Yes, and it's hard to even recognize the theme, but it's exactly the theme played in a minor key and with chromaticism surrounded. And here you go, you know, you have a variation like he did in the Handel variations. And then the first section comes back, and the scherzo ends in a very, very violent and passionate and dark gesture, very, very powerful. Then comes this gorgeous slow movement, and it's introduced by a long orchestral introduction with a solo by the principal cello. And it's one of the most beautiful things that Brahms wrote.
He was also great with those low strings, wasn't he?
Yes, absolutely. And this melody is so gorgeous. You know, it's worth coming to the concert just to hear these 3 minutes.
That's Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon, by the way.
Yes. And I'll play it on the piano. It sounds good, but of course, with the cello, it is just out of this world. And it goes on.
A love song.
Absolutely. It's really a love song. And the whole movement is based on this theme that when the piano comes in, the piano starts doing a variation on this theme. Brahms loved variations.
Apparently.
And he did write several sets of variations. And very often, this is how he uses the technique of the variation to develop his themes in his symphonies or chamber music works or concertos. And it's very interesting how he does that.
Very effective. Mm-hmm. And we're going to hear some more about this second piano concerto of Brahms, and also we'll have some individual pieces by other composers, all from Filippo Bianconi. We'll also, of course, have more conversation with him and find out about Fontainebleau and some other things when we return shortly. This is Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with pianist Filippo Bianconi, who's playing the Brahms second piano concerto with the Madison Symphony. Friday night, that's tomorrow night at 7:30, Saturday night at 8, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30 in the Overture Center in Madison. Also on that program, Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra and Debussy's La Mer. We have a couple of more themes yet that pertain to the Brahms second that you're talking us through as we get toward the finale.
Yes, absolutely. I spoke earlier about that very unusual finale. Most concertos have a very strong and, powerful finale. And here Brahms chooses a completely different mood for his finale, something very light and humorous. And here is the first theme presented by the piano and then repeated by the orchestra. So we haven't really heard anything like that before in the piece. And I find it so refreshing, you know. It's like it's in the spirit of, in the true spirit of a divertimento, like Haydn.
Except that you have a large orchestra doing this kind of light-footed ballet with the piano.
Yes, there are some powerful moments too, you know. Here and there, it goes really fortissimo. But it's in that same spirit. And then the second theme is this gypsy theme that Brahms loved so much. He used a lot of those, you know, when he lived in Vienna for many years, and he heard a lot of gypsy
music. Even some of those Hungarian dances have elements,
absolutely,
like the fourth in particular.
Absolutely. So here it goes. It does sound like one of the Hungarian dances. And so it's also the two themes are very, very contrasted. And you have a lot of moments that are really, as I said, like a divertimento, like this one, which is really absolutely delightful. And it's a play between the orchestra and, between the piano and the woodwinds. Unfortunately, I cannot play everything. So you have to go to the concert if you want to hear the whole, interplay between the instruments.
Starts to sound almost like Debussy.
Sort of, yes. Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll actually be hearing some Debussy a little later from you during this hour, from the Preludes. And between now and then, another composer whom we have mentioned in the context of piano concertos, but was probably really most at home as a soloist would be Chopin.
Oh, definitely. Chopin was really a pianist at heart, you know. And actually, he did write his concertos and a few other piano and orchestra pieces when he was young, because that was the way of becoming famous. But later on, he was not interested, and he, for the last 20 years of his life, he did not write any more concertos. He wrote only piano music, a little bit of chamber music, a few songs, but most of his compositions are for solo piano, of course.
And it was a time when, of course, we call it that umbrella term, Romanticism, in which there were certain kind of hallmarks of that era, and one of them was the sort of the implied story that you would get with a ballade that Chopin would write. I mean, in the case of his, what, four ballades, the story is very much left to the hearer, but there is an implication that there's some kind of narration going on.
Yes, actually, it is said that his four ballades were inspired by ballades of one of the great poets of his country, Poland, Mickiewicz. I'm not sure about the pronunciation of this name, but it is said that the ballads of Mickiewicz inspired Chopin. And I don't think it's really necessary to compare what Chopin wrote to the actual poems, because it's really pure music. I mean, the ballads do not illustrate anything, I think. But they have this quality of narration. You know, it's pure music telling a story. Don't ask me which story they're telling.
I was just going to ask you. So if you play this third of the four ballades, do you have a story that comes to mind, or is it remain pure music for you?
Frankly, no. And I don't have I don't feel it necessary to imagine a story. I mean, the music speaks by itself, and it speaks of emotions, and it has that narrative quality, the way it develops, the way the themes go from one to the other. It does sound like a story, but I do not need, personally, I do not need to relate it to a to any kind of literature. I mean, the music speaks by itself.
Well, so as we listen, we can each, if we want to, come up with our own storyline or listen to it as pure music. This is the third of the four Chopin ballades.
Thank you.
Bravo. John Field once said of Frederic Chopin, rather notoriously, that he was a sick room talent, but you certainly couldn't pull off something like that ballade without being quite robust.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Back with Felipe Anconi and some pieces by Debussy when we return in a moment. This is WPR. Back with Felipe Anconi, who's in Wisconsin to perform with the Madison Symphony this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and those will be evening concerts, and then Sunday afternoon he's going to be performing the Brahms Second Piano Concerto. And now we come almost to the other extreme with these miniatures by Debussy. Do you feel a certain affinity for Debussy, or is that making an assumption?
Well,
given your nationality,
I do have a very special affinity with Debussy, and I don't know if that has anything to do with my nationality, because you know I know people in France who don't care very much for Debussy, but I do have that particular feeling for this music. It's so wonderful. What I really love about Debussy is the mystery. I think it's a very mysterious music.
So some nice colorful titles to go with it.
Oh, absolutely. The titles are so evocative. They're so wonderful. Some of them are taken from poems, but they also take you very far. And again, I mean, this has nothing to do with Chopin, who never used titles, as such precise titles. Chopin always used musical titles. But Debussy used titles just to probably arouse your imagination. I don't think the music is literally... illustrating the titles. And especially in the preludes, it's very interesting because Debussy wrote the titles at the end of each piece,
uh-huh,
in parentheses, which means that it's more even a suggestion than a real illustration of the title. But it does help your imagination, you know, open, as I said, the mystery in this music is so deep, it's so incredible, because it goes into things of the unconscious. There's also always a little bit of, I'm going to use a German word, you know, angst in Debussy's music, because there's, even in the happy and lighter pieces, there is always this terror of death, of time passing by, and the fact that nothing lasts. You know, that these pieces are just a moment between the two infinites. You know, it's... And I think Debussy tries to understand this mystery of life, of being, without really explaining it. But he goes very deep into that and into the unconscious.
And that's true of this first one that you have in mind?
I think so. It's I've been thinking of playing for you the fourth prelude from book one. It's Les sons et les parfums tournent dans l'air du soir. It's a beautiful line from a poem of our great French poet Baudelaire. And in English, that would be approximately sounds and perfumes swirl in the evening air. And it's a very dreamy piece, like a nocturne, of course, very intimate. And a moment before the end, there is this dark passage which refers to this angst I was talking about, you know, and the fright of death and of beautiful things that do not last.
Very evocative of something.
Yes, it's very evocative. It's so poetic. It's just wonderful.
Well, we have time for just one more, unfortunately, but it's one that illustrates this tendency of or tradition of French composers to get inspiration from Spain.
Yes.
Common phenomenon.
Absolutely. Of course, Chabrier wrote some Spanish music.
Not to mention Bizet.
Yeah, not to mention Bizet, and Ravel wrote some beautiful Spanish music too. And here is one of the most incredible Spanish music by a French composer. It's the third prelude from Book Two, La Puerta del Vino. It's evocative of the old city of Granada. Thank you.
La Puerta del Vino of Debussy, and one of, again, those evocative preludes. In this case, I think, at least in a general sense, we're aware that we're hearing a Spanish-influenced piece.
Yes, definitely, with the habanera rhythm and some of the harmonies.
Now, you just recently became the director of the American Conservatory in Fontainebleau, and you're following in the footsteps of some prestigious people. I mean, Philippe Entremont, just before you for 20 years, another great pianist, and Nadia Boulanger for quite a while. And she was one of the great teachers and influences in a vast part of the 20th century. And was Ravel even also connected with it?
Yes, Ravel was the director actually for just 1 year at the very beginning of the American Conservatory in the 1920s. So there has been a number of really great, great musicians. And you mentioned Nadia Boulanger. She was probably the most influential because she was director for over 30 years and she was a major, major figure in 20th century music. A lot of great musicians, composers, of course, a lot of great American composers went to Fontainebleau to study with her. And as you said, Philippe Entremont was the director for the last 20 years. And I have been teaching regularly there in the summer in Fontainebleau under his direction. And he resigned just a few months ago. And I was, very warmly recommended to succeed, and I accepted, and it's a very big responsibility. I'm very happy, but at the same time, a little bit nervous because of, those great people that you mentioned, and it's a great, great responsibility to be director of this great institution.
Well, Philippe Bianconi, thank you for joining us again today and sharing some music from our Buck studio. It's been a great pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.